It's the Wiggins Sessions, a show where key thinkers and industry pioneers discuss politics, economics, philosophy, and history. Big ideas impacting the economy, the financial markets, and our lives. Here's your host, Addison Wiggin.
Ray Blanco is our science advisor and editor of Breakthrough Technology Alert, Technology Profits Confidential, and the FDA Trader. In all of these, he breaks down the science and offers investments in technology and biotech companies. Ready? Let's jam. Welcome to the Wiggins Sessions. I'm your host, Addison Wiggins. This is Surviving and Thriving Through the Post-Pandemic Economy. And today we have Ray Blanco, who has been our science advisor through several episodes. So welcome, Ray. I just want to talk to you. I want to get to catch up on what's going on. I want to talk about the Delta variant, because that's been the subject that is like taking over the news.
Right.
But I'm very skeptical. So maybe if we could get some science behind it, then I can understand it.
Sure.
It bothers me that we've had this push to get vaccinated. My whole family is vaccinated both times.
I'm not vaccinated yet. Not
vaccinated. Okay. So maybe this would be an interesting conversation.
I prefer long-term data. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's the
My wife and I got vaccinated because we had an opportunity way before, you know, the max vax sites were open.
Right.
And she actually had the same cancer that you had when you were 19. And she was 19 as well.
Your wife?
Yes. And she's had two more episodes since then.
Where's she from, by the way?
Well, she's from New Jersey. She was born in the Bronx.
And okay.
Grew up in New Jersey, but she's Philippine by heritage.
All right. Now, my wife is Philippine by birth, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I met her in college in Colorado. So.
Cool.
But she had Hodgkin's when she was 19, same as you.
Yeah. It's more common in young men than it is in young women.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what they said at the time. I don't know why that is the case, but it's one of those cancers that, you know, younger people tend to get more of. Cancer generally being pretty age-related, you know. Young people don't get cancer at near the same rates. But for some reason, Hodgkin's is one of the more common youth cancers.
Yeah. Well, she got it just like you got it. I mean, I think that's something that, well, I don't have in common with you, but she does. Back then, the radiation that they gave her caused breast cancer.
Oh, wow. So she had it in her neck or her chest?
She had it like, that same scar. Exactly.
Yeah. I have the scar right here.
Yeah.
And then I got, you know, radiation. I got pretty sick. You know, that stuff will really ruin your appetite. The skin on my neck burned off. I lost
same thing.
Hair on the back of my head, never really grew back the same.
So she had the same thing. And then the knock-on effect was 20 years later, she got breast cancer. And then when we were doing, we're involved with Johns Hopkins because we live here in Baltimore. And
right.
When we were doing research on it, we discovered a report that said that class of people who got radiation at that time, which I think is the same class that you were in, developed breast cancer at like a 40% rate higher than the general population.
So this would be the mid 90s, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
that's interesting. What they did tell me, I was at higher risk for, you know, some heart condition when I got older. So, you know, I've been fine so far, you know, but so, you know, something I do worry about a little bit, keep an eye on. I get checked.
Well, then we discovered, we made that link. And then just last year, was it? No, it was 2019. She was diagnosed with thyroid cancer and they connected it to the radiation as well. So anyway, this is a long way of saying we're taking the vaxes because we're like uber aware of her condition. And she's actually super healthy, and she's very conscious of her health.
Yeah.
She eats well and she exercises and all that kind of stuff. She's not sick in any way, but she's like very aware.
Thyroid. What did they do with her thyroid? Did they give her like radioactive iodine?
No, they took it out.
They took it out. That's super common these days, particularly in women. I don't know why it happens so much. You know, maybe there's something environmental that we've been exposed to.
What they told her was it was a reaction to the radiation.
Yeah.
So anyway, so let's just draw that back to the vaccinations, because
sure,
there's a lot of people that are very wary of getting them. But I'm thinking we're going through a phase of medical history where we just learn how to use a new vaccination, just like the Spanish flu. Like,
right,
we had to learn how to deal with the flu. Now we have to deal with COVID, and it's COVID-19. So that means we've been dealing with this for a long time. Well, my initial question was the Delta variant, because that seems to be sort of the latest sort of political spin on the thing. We gotta deal with that, and I wonder what you think about that.
So, backing off the politics initially, let's look at what we know scientifically. What I know, at least, is that, you know, it's a mutation of the COVID-19 virus.
Why do we call it Delta? Why isn't it like COVID-20?
You know, I don't know the actual nomenclature, how they come up with that. You know, with flu viruses, they have their own nomenclature, but it is a COVID-19 coronavirus, and it's a very, you know, you have the alpha, the several variants out there, right? I don't know who chose to call it Delta. Maybe somebody at the CDC or at the World Health Organization.
Dr. Fauci.
Maybe it was Fauci's idea. I don't know. But, you know, it's more contagious. That we do know. Apparently considerably more contagious than the original version of the virus. And, you know, we're seeing cases pick up in a lot of places.
Even here in Maryland. It's like picking up. But also, that's another question that I have, is it's picking up, but I think there was only 3 new cases yesterday. It's not like what was happening a year ago.
No, yeah, it's nowhere near. But, you know, every trend starts with a little uptick or downtick, right? So it does bear watching. Now, you know, there's a lot that we still have to learn about this particular variant. I think Israel is an interesting case. So I saw some information yesterday on the daily caseload in Israel. So Israel's kind of a test case for the vaccination program and herd immunity. So Israel was one of the first countries to really get a high percentage of the population vaccinated. They used a vaccine with some decent numbers, which is the Pfizer vaccine. They didn't do, yeah, you know,
that was early, right?
Yeah, and they hit it hard and they hit it early. And it's a small country. It's a few million people. Logistically, you're not dealing with a situation like the United States, right? So they were able to do that, and they're also a wealthy country, so they could afford to move really fast. Now,
and they could close their borders.
Yeah, exactly. So what they've been seeing is an uptick, and the last few days, or at least maybe Wednesday, what they're seeing is that more than half of the new cases are previously vaccinated people. So the vaccine, you know, like the Pfizer vaccine at least, is not completely protective, apparently, against the Delta variant. At least it looks that way based on what I'm seeing in Israel, okay? Obviously, we need more information here. I don't want to, you know, anger Dr. Fauci and give you misinformation. And another thing that they're seeing is the percentage of people that were previously infected is very small percentage of reinfections. So just looking at that little slice of data, it looks like if you've been previously infected, you've actually got more protection against the Delta variant than if you took the vaccine. At least it looks that way. It's suggestive, okay? I don't want to say it is. Forget it. It's a fact. Now, here's another thing we do know, however, which I think completely changes the game, although politically, that's a different situation, is that if you've been vaccinated, you still have a huge amount of protection, even if you caught the new variant. You're highly protected against it, you know, putting you in the ICU, in the hospital, with a really severe case. So you could catch it again, the new variant, but the odds of it making you really, really sick are greatly reduced over unvaccinated person. And as you know, the groups of people that are really susceptible to a really bad case are, you know, older folks over the age of, I don't know, like 60, and people with just chronic health conditions that are, you know, not too healthy to begin with.
All right. So maybe we should get into the science of the mRNA inhibitor, right? Isn't that what it is? There's like a protein that's injected, and then like if there's a variant, how does the vaccine not work? Like that's kind of what I'm curious about, because I keep hearing that, oh, now we need booster shots.
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry loves all this money and wants to keep the gravy train going.
Yeah. Isn't that all right? So that's where I get cynical and sort of skeptical. Like, all right, are we actually, what are we doing? We're just paying money for drugs.
I'm very cynical myself. So, but yeah, you know, we got to tease out what is actually needed over from what's just political and freeloading and stuff like that. But
yeah, let's get into the science of it then, because it would be helpful.
All right. So mRNA, the mRNA vaccines, we've got the Moderna and we've got the Pfizer. Moderna is a purely mRNA platform company. Okay. So that's all they do. And they were in the right place at the right time with the right technology to really make their investors happy and help solve, or at least help work on a big problem. So the way these vaccines work, it helps to go back to just what's known as the central dogma of biology, which is genetic information is stored in the DNA, and the DNA is translated into proteins. And then the proteins are what make up your cell and all of its function and its structure and everything else. So the way that happens is, so the data is stored in, you know, you got a master database, the DNA in the nucleus of your cell, and it's sitting there, but it doesn't do anything when it's there. You've got to be able to read it, make a copy of it, take it to a manufacturing plant inside the cell, okay, which is the ribosome, read the copy, and then execute the instructions. You know, read the copy of the blueprint and build the thing that you're building. And the actual mechanism that does that is the messenger RNAs, that they're basically, they transport these copies from the central database, a little piece of the blueprint, to the ribosome, and then the ribosome makes it. There's a heck of a lot more going on here. It's really complex. I struggle with it myself, but that's it in a nutshell. So what we've been able to do with mRNA vaccine technology is that we can synthetically make our own little piece of RNA, messenger RNA, okay? And with special technology, in the Moderna's case, they use a thing called a lipid nanoparticle. So they attach or encapsulate this mRNA construct to this lipid nanoparticle. The reason they do that is so that it will go in the cell. It won't really readily go in the cell otherwise. So they had to come up with this delivery hack to get it to go in the cell. Once inside the cell, it's freed of the lipid nanoparticle, okay? It's sitting in there in the cytoplasm. The cell processes it exactly as if it were a natively made mRNA, okay? So if you're, so in the case of the COVID vaccine, it's RNA that codes for, as we all know, the spike protein, right? On the outside of the COVID-19 virus capsid. So this goes through the ribosome. The ribosome executes the instructions and makes the spike protein. The spike protein is able to migrate outside the cell, okay? And it's floating around there in your bloodstream. Your body's detecting it. Your immune system's looking at it. It's recognizing it as foreign. It's generating an immune response. And since the immune system, another highly complex mechanism here, has a memory, it's able to react to the actual infection if it should ever occur with much greater speed. You gave it, given it a head start. So, you know, the big difference is the way we've been doing it since the very beginning. I mean, we're talking about Jenner here noticing that milkmaids never got smallpox. And he investigated that, and he figured out they were getting an infection from the cows called cowpox. Apparently, cowpox was very closely related to smallpox. So if you got this weaker virus, cowpox, you developed natural immunity to smallpox. So he started experimenting with that. They give you a cut. It was before hypodermic needles. They give you a cut, rub somebody's scab in your cut, all right? And then, you know, the experimentation he did isn't exactly ethical. He experimented on people. He'd expose them to smallpox, and they wouldn't get sick. So that's how it all started. But ever since that time, we've been using inactivated or weakened viruses. And the virus, you know, you get exposed to it, you develop immunity to the decoy, and then when you get exposed to the real thing, your body already has a head start. You know, one of the reasons we're able to bring it to market so fast, we've completely cut that out, and we can go directly to manufacturing the actual antigens that we desire in situ, in the cell, in the body, and doing it that way. So it's a completely different modality, and here's the thing. This is way bigger than just prophylactic vaccines against viral infections. What Moderna has is a pretty incredible platform for all kinds of stuff. I mean, which I could get into if you have time.
Yeah, actually, I'm interested in that because, like, during these sort of episodes in history, the knowledge that we gain speeds up really fast because there's like a lot of urgency to produce a vaccine or whatever. But this is not injecting a version of the virus into the body. This is like genetic engineering, which we've learned a lot about in like the last 10 years, but now we're actually using it. So it feels to me like just from trying to understand the process, like we're moving beyond our response to pandemics very quickly based on technology that has been developed in the last decade.
Yeah.
This is genetic engineering in process. I think this is also what is kind of freaking people out. They're like, right. I don't want to be an experiment.
There's a lot of misinformation. It's not messing with your genome. The RNAs don't stay there forever. They only stay for a while. They get processed and they get broken up and discarded as junk. So it's not like you're making a permanent change to your cells. With, you know, gene editing therapies, you are, but not with this. This is not a permanent change in what's written into your cell lines. So it's, you know, you're not turning yourself into a mutant or a chimera or something like that when you use an mRNA vaccine.
So it's not really a vaccine.
So the thing itself is not a vaccine, but it creates so instead of making the antigens in a bio facility, you're making the antigens in your body. So you become the actual vaccine plant when you take an mRNA vaccine. Okay, so that's basically what's going on here.
Yeah.
And it's applicable to not just COVID-19. I mean, there's flu vaccines, HIV.
Yeah, I mean, so the application is like widespread if we get it right. Gets it right. What's different between that one and the Pfizer one?
The Pfizer one is very similar. It's an mRNA vaccine. I don't know what particular delivery technology Pfizer's using. And obviously, Pfizer's much more than an mRNA company. They're a big pharma. They've got all kinds of stuff that they're working on from, you know, in-house R&D plus acquisitions and partnerships with small biotechs. Mm-hmm. Which is where the game is really being played, right?
Yeah, we can talk about that in a minute because that's what you cover.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. So don't think of the mRNA technology as vaccine only, okay? Although it can be used for that. So I have the power to put a little bit of code in your body and tell your body to make anything I want, basically. Think of it that way. So imagine, so let's just talk about cancer vaccine. I could train your immune system against cancer. All right, look at, you know, think of the applications that potentially are there for that. But it's more than just that. So let's say you're born with a genetic defect and you are lacking an enzyme that breaks down a lipid or a complex sugar in your cells. And, you know, due to that, you know, the stuff builds up in your cells and you're a very sick person, some extreme types of lysosomal storage disorders. You know, people don't even make it to adulthood because they don't make a crucial enzyme that you have to have for garbage collection purposes in your cells. Now, there's been, you know, incredible biotech success stories and companies that have been able to use synthetic biology to create synthetic enzymes and enzyme replacement therapy. You know, these therapies will run some of them $400,000 a year, okay, these rare disease ERTs. So, but
that's, you know, to cover the investment that the company's made, right?
Right. Well, yeah, it's a very small patient population. Yeah. Plus, if you get an FDA designation for a rare orphan disease, you get a special amount of exclusivity and incentives. Because let's face it, I've got $100 million to invest, very risky venture in a new therapy. Where am I going to put my money? In the disease that affects 5 million people or in the disease that affects 5,000. Common sense is I'm going after the market of 5 million. And that was a problem in pharmaceutical land for a long time. But then in the 80s, it passed the Orphan Disease Act that created a number of incentives for, you know, biopharma to develop for these smaller rare disease groups, which includes a lot of these people with, you know, lysosomal storage disorders and stuff like that. Now, not all of these can possibly be treated with enzyme replacement therapies. So what if I could make an mRNA therapy that goes right into your cell and then your cell makes the necessary enzyme? You see the application here? So it's not a vaccine at all, but I can tell your cells to make, you know, within reason, I suppose, anything I want. And I could potentially treat undruggable diseases this way because I'm not giving you the actual compound, I'm having your cells make the compound for you. So, you know, maybe there's an enzyme that I cannot get into your cell because it's too big or something else, but my mRNA can get in and my mRNA will tell your cell to make this thing that you need to stay alive. So a lot of potential there.
I think I want to understand that a little bit better. Like, how do we program on that level? Like, it's a microscopic level. Like, how do we actually program mRNA to work with the cells?
Well,
a messenger mRNA is going to go in and work at the cellular level. Like, that's confusing to me.
Well, we're able to read, for example, in the case of the virus, the spike protein, right?
Yeah.
We're able to sequence the viral genome and read data. So we basically make a copy of it or a very close copy of it. And we have methods of manufacturing it now. You know, there's I don't know it in detail, but it exists. Same thing with a human gene. We know what the gene is for the, you know, for an enzyme. Okay. So we basically make an mRNA construct that is analogous to that and functional in the body. You know, other applications, you know, this is Moderna's working on this. So you have a heart attack. We want to help your heart tissue grow back again. Okay. So why not an mRNA therapy to the heart muscle that helps your cells secrete growth factors so your blood vessels grow back in and your muscle, your heart muscle cells grow, you know, cardiac tissue grows back in and stuff like that. So it's a huge platform. And I mean, they're just going after what they see as the low-hanging fruit right now, which is the way you do it. I mean, you don't go for the risky stuff. You go for the easiest stuff you can get so you can get on market quickly and cheaply. But, you know.
So that's what you meant by saying that Moderna was doing the right technology at the right time when the pandemic hit.
We very quickly got a genome for the virus. The Chinese released it. And people jumped on it right away. They were able to read it. They were able to create mRNA constructs or DNA constructs. That's a somewhat similar technology, although that hasn't been on the market yet. Maybe it will be. And be able to create, you know, prototype that they can test in the lab and fine-tune and then get it out into volunteers very quickly. Very unique set of circumstances. I will compare it to, like, World War II, there was this explosion in new technology. It was an emergency situation. We had to deal. We threw a bunch of money at the problem. On the pharmaceutical side, we knew we had this wonder molecule called penicillin, right? And we knew if we could get it out there, it could potentially save thousands and thousands of lives of wounded soldiers. But, you know, it was as scarce as platinum and worth more than gold. I mean, Churchill got really sick once. They gave him penicillin, a little bit of the scarce, precious world penicillin supply. And they actually collected his urine to process it and get the penicillin back. So this is how the situation before World War II. We figured out how to mass produce the stuff, and then we got it out in mass, you know, to the military. So, you know, that's kind of what happened here. It wasn't.
Yeah, that's the analogy I was trying to make. I personally am allergic to penicillin, so I can't take it, but it helps millions of people on a regular basis. So this technology that's being developed to deal with the virus is going to be, it's going to be very productive for a lot of people. Although I'll just be honest. I did two sessions, like two, what do they call them? Jabs. The Moderna. So I did my first one and my second one. And I literally have not felt the same since.
You felt poorly?
No, I don't feel bad. Like, I don't feel like I have the flu or anything like that, but my body feels different. I my toes are numb. And it doesn't happen every day, but some days I wake up and my whole hands are numb. And it only started happening after the second dose.
Well, once
so I think there's a lot of people that are they're just like skeptical that like you start messing around with your genes. it could be a problem.
It might not be the actual mRNA at all, but the antigen it codes for. So, you know, you've heard about some of the safety issues with these mRNA vaccines and cardiovascular inflammation in young males.
I'm worried about that too.
You know, it's possible that the spike protein itself is not really good for your cardiovascular system. It's an inflammatory.
Gary.
yeah.
I don't like you and Patrick used to write about inflammaging. Like as a problem, and like if you inject these types of vaccines into your body, are you encouraging the inflammation?
The antigen does cause some inflammatory problems in some people. That we do know. I mean, the CDC released an alert on that and a warning about it. So,
it sounds like it's also in young people too, like that.
And the thing is, with the vaccine, we have to be sane about this. They want a vaccine, the pharma companies especially, okay? They want to vaccinate every last man, woman, and child. But we got to think about risk-benefit, I think. If you're an older person, the risk-benefit, well, the benefit definitely outweighs the risk, okay? But, you know, my kids, I've got an infant. I've got a 3-year-old. I've got an 11-year-old, and I got a 14-year-old. You know what the death rate is for that age group? It's like it's almost non-existent. What's the risk benefit of getting them vaccinated? Mm-hmm. You know, the benefit is almost non-existent. Okay. So I think we should just concentrate. My personal opinion, and I know Fauci is going to disagree with me on this, but I don't care. Just concentrate on our at-risk population, get them protected, and then everybody else just go on and live your life. That's the way I see it.
Yeah. And so that's why you chose. I mean, so far you're not vaccinated.
Yeah, I'm waiting for a little more long-term data. Yeah. Normally a vaccine takes like 10 to 15 years to develop. So you get some long-term data there. Okay.
So now I'm thinking, what did I do?
The bar is very high for a vaccine. Really, really high for a prophylactic vaccine.
Yeah.
All right. It's not like, for example, a cancer therapy. All right. Your late stage cancer, you got 3 months to live. You know, the risk benefit there, they can give you some really toxic stuff and it's perfectly justified. Okay. But in a normal, healthy person, to prevent an infection, the bar is way, way higher than with a cancer drug with some severe side effects. You don't give a healthy person something with severe side effects unless they're not healthy and they're about to die on you. And this is a super, dire intervention. So it takes a long time. It takes huge populations of patients and years of testing before these things get to market. Now, what we've had with COVID-19, we had huge trials, 30,000 people trials. But what we haven't had is years of data after administration. So it's just something to consider. I don't want to be a fearmonger, but it's not a normal vaccine situation is what I'm trying to say.
How much do you consider politics playing a part in trying to get everyone vaccinated?
I think it's a huge, disgusting affair. I think the American people have lost a lot of trust in our experts for a lot of reasons. But I think the whole vaccine debacle was a big part of it. We've been deliberately lied to. Fauci's lied to the American people. He's a big one there. I mean, you expect I'm very disappointed in Fauci when this whole thing began. I looked at him. I thought I was a good judge of his character. I was like, finally, we have a real public servant, someone who's what's most important to him is doing a good job at serving his people, the American people. And he lied to us. You don't need masks. Right at the beginning. And then then a few months later, he flips and he says, you got to wear a mask, and it's ridiculous. And I think, people have lost a lot of trust and there's been a lot of information control in social media, which has been completely manipulated by the government regarding the virus. I mean, we had people kicked off of Twitter for daring to suggest that, hey, the virus is probably an escape from a Chinese lab. And it wouldn't be the first time, by the way. And then now, finally, they've come around saying this thing probably escaped from a Chinese lab.
Yeah, even the WHO is saying that now.
which the Chinese are not happy about. And it's probably, we've had many escapes. This one just, went viral, which is a good word. This one actually went viral, okay, and spread to the world. There was I think in the late 70s, they called it the Russian flu. It didn't actually originate in Russia. Apparently it originated in China. They were developing a flu vaccine or something like that, and it got out. And it was actually not, something got out. It was this flu. And, I think it killed a few hundred thousand people that year that it broke out. So
how does that happen? How does it, I've been wondering about that too. How does it actually escape? Somebody has it, and then they get transported to a hospital, and then it gets transported to another, a worker, and then another patient. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, this virus transmits person to person. We know this. China denied it at the beginning. They lied. They knew it transmitted person to person. But, somebody in the lab, they made a mistake. They violated a protocol, and they got infected, and then they go out. They go out, they leave, they go out in public and they cough or they just breathe or they sneeze. Somebody else gets it and they go on to affect two or three people. And then they go, each of those people goes on to affect two or three people. And the thing's like a snowball rolling downhill, gets bigger and bigger as it goes. So, you know, they have not found an animal reservoir for this virus. And the likeliest thing is that they were doing gain of, I mean, we know they were doing gain of function research in that Wuhan lab. Yeah. The thing got out. And listen, let's not act like we're so much better. These things have happened in the United States in our labs before. We've just been, you know, pretty lucky that it hasn't turned out like the COVID-19 virus has.
Yes. So, let's explain that phrase, gain of function.
Okay, so gain of function research is they'll take a virus and they'll try to make it, they'll add function to it. They'll, you know, in the case of a virus like COVID-19, they'll take a bat virus and make it more amenable to infecting human cells to study how viruses infect humans and to design ways to stop the virus. So that way, when something similar happens in nature, you already got a basic idea of how to fight it. So that's what's known as gain of function research. It's kind of sort of indistinguishable from bioweapons research, because if I wanted to make something that would kill a lot of people, I'd be doing essentially the same thing, trying to make a deadly virus or making a bad virus worse or making it more transmissible or something like that.
So gain of function is kind of like, I know it's scientific research, but it's kind of like a mathematical equation, like trying to figure out if this, then that.
Right. So, you know, I might modify the virus so that it won't latch on to a bat or mouse or whatever organism cell. I might modify it so it'll latch on to a human cell. So that's a gain of function. Or I might make it more easy to enter a human cell or something like that. And, you know, I've added function to that virus. It's a gain of function. And, you know, that's been going on in Chinese labs. And the U.S. has funded some of that stuff through the NIH.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's rumors that that Fauci was the one who signed. I don't know where this came from. This came from mainstream media, but that he signed the check that went to the Wuhan lab.
Yeah,
I think Senator. I just read stuff and I'm like, really?
But Senator Rand Paul raked him over the coals for that.
Yeah,
which I'm fine with, by the way. we were obviously involved to an extent in terms of funding.
Yeah,
because the scientific information is shared. So whether we do it here or we do it over there, we do get, you know, the papers get published, the scientific research gets published, and the whole world gets to read this stuff and you know, supposedly benefit. But in this case, it turned out to be, you know, Frankenstein's monster of a disaster.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on from the virus, if you want.
Sure.
I would like to ask you about the about Branson going into space and then Bezos trying to catch up, like they call it the billionaire space race. I'd like to ask you, oh, well, Musk is involved too.
Yeah.
Like what your take on that is, because it like it's kind of like a PR campaign for Branson to have gone into space, and it looks like Bezos is doing the same thing. What are we gaining from doing any of that? Like literally, I was watching, it was a couple days ago, 3 days ago, 4 days ago. I was watching Branson talk about his launch into space, and I'm like,
what does that do for me?
No, I was like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like maybe it was fun for you. Like, do I want to go into space? Not really.
Well, what Branson's building is a space tourism business where high net worth people can plunk down $150,000.
$250,000.
Is it $250,000? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was plunk down, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for the roller coaster ride. It's a glorified roller coaster ride, right? The roller coaster ride of your lifetime. You reach the NASA definition of space with Branson, which is 50 miles up. So when he went up 280,000 feet, 53 miles, he reached the NASA definition of space. That's not the international definition of space, by the way, but it's NASA's definition of space, and was weightless for a brief period of time. I don't know if he was able to float around the capsule or if he stayed strapped down. And then they safely re-entered and landed at the spaceport in the Mojave Desert that they built there. Very interesting. Then you've got Bezos. He's going to do the same thing here in, 4 days? July 20th is when he's going to go up. And he says, you may be first, but I've got bragging rights. All right? This is
Bezos. I'm going to go higher.
I'm going to go higher. I'm going to pass the Karman line, which is 100 kilometers, which is the international definition of space. It's number one. Number two, you're flying on a rocket. That's way cooler than an airplane. Number three, we got bigger windows. So he's going up with his brother, and I don't know who else, on his, the New Shepard or New Glenn rocket. And the capsule's going to come back down, parachute. And I don't know where they're going to land, really. So what is the big deal about this? I can't afford a trip, and I wouldn't pay for it even if I could afford it, I don't think.
I wouldn't.
I'd probably get pretty motion sick, I think. Although I'm not very prone to motion sickness, but they were doing these zero G things in aircraft to train astronauts.
Oh, yeah.
They called the airplane the Vomit Comet, okay? Because people get really sick from the changes in G force when they were on board. So, I don't know if I want to put down $250,000 to get on a Vomit Comet myself. But, there's some interesting historical, I guess, could be an analogy to what's going on now. So, the Wright brothers invented the airplane. It was, something that was not immediately useful. World War One happened not long later. The technology had become refined just enough that people saw tremendous military utility in aircraft. You could fly over the trench and see where the enemy was, so you could direct artillery fire. And then people started figuring out, hey, we could just drop bombs off these things and kill the enemy. The war ends. You got a ton of surplus aircraft. They're really not such great aircraft by our standards. But people were plunking down big money to get in a plane with one of these barnstorming pilots, be able to get up in the air and look around, be able to tell all their friends at the golf course, oh, this aircraft stuff's amazing. I've been up in an airplane. We were up 3,000 feet. You could see the whole town from up there. And stuff like that. An analogy, people weren't flying transatlantic in the 1920s. The technology simply did not exist yet to enable really practical mass travel over long distances. But the industry, the commercial side, did kind of get a start with these, joy seekers, these thrill riders. And that's what we're looking at right now. And potentially the technology could become refined enough to do something useful, like, London, Sydney in an hour or two would be really nice, I think, if it's cheap enough to be able to, for people to be able to do that. Yeah. Go suborbital, not a full orbit, but point-to-point, super high-speed travel. Yeah. And as you might know, Branson's company, Virgin Galactic, they've got contracts with NASA researching this kind of stuff, high-speed point-to-point transportation. Who knows, maybe in 20 years, what started out as, a glorified roller coaster ride on a Vomit Comet could potentially turn into really high-speed international travel. Like when I go to Asia, sometimes it takes me 30 hours. It's awful from where I live. It'd be really nice to just hop on a plane in Miami, end up in, land in Tokyo or Seoul, a couple hours later. You know what I mean? It would be pretty cool.
I guess that's how innovation happens.
Yeah, the novelty of it is the start, I suppose.
Yeah. It's just funny because I'm like, I don't really want to go into space. When I'm seeing it, I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I'd be comfortable with that.
When I was a kid, I went through a phase a lot of American kids do, right? I wanted to be an astronaut, right?
Yeah.
But now that I'm older, I'm thinking about it and would I want to live up there? I mean, it's so nice living on Earth. I mean, imagine living in space. You're basically in a pressurized can.
Yeah.
You can't walk out your front door. You can't breathe the free air. Living things all around. You don't get any of that.
I don't know her name, but it is kind of cool that the co-pilot of that plane was a young woman who wanted to be an astronaut, and she got denied from NASA and all that kind of stuff. And then she started working for Virgin Galactic, and she's like, I think she's like the CEO or the CFO or something. I actually don't know her name. It'd probably be worth researching and getting it right. But she was able to do it. Like, that was her dream, and she was able to do it. So that's kind of a cool thing.
Well, I mean, we've had women do tremendous things in space.
No, but I mean, she was sort of like the, you know, Branson's the PR guy.
Yeah.
He was the architect of the whole thing. And they had 800 engineers on that plane.
We had Grace Hopper. Without her code, computer code, we couldn't have landed on the moon. The CEO of SpaceX, Glenn Shotwell, that's another space lady right there. So I think the next footstep on the moon is probably going to be a female. That's what they say.
If we want to go to the moon again.
Oh, yeah, well, they seem like they're pretty setting the term on that. So,
all right, let's just, since we're on the subject, let's talk about innovation for a bit, because you've been writing about how innovation leads to products that have deflationary or just like price declines that are productive for individuals, guys like you and me.
Yeah, I mean, that's what technology is for. It's for two things: to do things that we couldn't do before that we'd like to do and we want or need to do, you know, like going on a suborbital thrill ride, or doing things that we already do better, cheaper, faster, in some way, shape, or form. A big emphasis probably on cheaper. And that's what technology does. It reduces the price of things. And we've had deflationary, technology-driven deflationary periods in this country before. There was a 20-year period in this country in the late 1900s, between about 1870 and 1890, that they called it the Great Deflation or the Great SAG. And nobody suffered. Deflation is sort of like the natural benefit that accrues from human genius, human imagination, human hard work, and what results from that, you know, technology. So, you know, prices on manufactured goods fell precipitously during that period, and wages did not. So by 1890 in U.S. dollars, you could buy a lot more stuff than you could in 1870. And, you know, this was pretty much coincident with what you might call the second industrial revolution. So there was the first industrial revolution, started in England in the textile industries. We started replacing muscle power with machine power, and we started using machines to augment what we could do with our hands in produce and manufacturing things. The second industrial revolution, which is the period that I just referred to, we had things like, you know, rail, telegraphs, steamships, interchangeable parts, and things like that, that greatly improved our ability to make stuff and make stuff cheaper. The third, industrial revolution, earlier 20th century, you know, automobiles, airplanes, and things like that. Actually, I don't know if that counts as part, but definitely the third industrial revolution we've experienced it in our own lifetimes, and that you can chalk it down to the computer chip, semiconductors, transistors, integrated circuits. The whole second half of the 20th century was all about that. And again, in certain, you know, deflationary in many areas, a lot of things we can do cheaper now. I mean, can you imagine without the internet, without this computer, what it would cost me to fly to you and sit there next to you and us do this show? And first of all, I mean, how would you propagate it? Nobody's on the internet, right?
Yeah.
So we're right now at the cusp of what they're calling the fourth industrial revolution, which is, you know, artificial intelligence, 5G, robotics, Internet of Things, machine-to-machine communications. We've got stuff like, you know, self-driving cars that look like they're going to become a thing in a few years. 3D printing slowly but surely gaining traction. You got, billions of dollars being invested in quantum computing. We'll see where that goes over the. They're predicting that technology's share of the U.S. economy in terms of GDP is going to double between now and the end of the decade. The impact is going to be 100 times greater than any of the previous industrial revolutions. So the impact, things are going to be
quicker, so cheap. And quicker.
Quick. How cheap are things going to get? A lot of things. The things that are expensive now are largely labor intensive, okay? But if, as we replace labor with machines, they get a lot cheaper. So you got to ask yourself, I mean, you know, I could go down to the gas station, pick up a t-shirt for $5. You know, 150, 200 years ago, you might have to work for weeks for a new suit of clothes to be able to afford it. How cheap are clothes now in terms of what your typical person earns? You know, a fraction, a small fraction of the price. Why are clothes so cheap? We know the answer to that one. So we're going through a situation now. It's going to be incredibly disruptive, but it, you know, everybody's talking about inflation at the moment, but the long-term thing that's going on is this technological revolution, and it is strongly deflationary.
All right. So why don't we start wrapping this up? And I appreciate all your ideas. Do you have like two or three picks that you're really excited about right now?
Oh, wow. Well, I don't want to reveal what I've got coming up. I think the chip sector is very strong. I've said that before.
Are you worried in the chip sector? Are you worried at all about China and the Taiwan situation?
So China doesn't makes a significant number of chips. Okay. But they're like in the single digits of global production. The U.S. is like...
Taiwan is like the largest.
Taiwan is like two-thirds of global chip production.
Yeah.
Other big ones, I mean, Taiwan is by far the biggest, okay? You got, of course, South Korea, where Samsung is, and you've got Japan, and you've got the U.S. You know, chips are made in Europe and, you know, in Israel, but the big one is Taiwan. China can't corner the market on chips, you know, unless they invade and take over Taiwan.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Are you worried about them, like in the political sense, are you worried about them taking, like just saying, all right, we're going to take the chip industry in Taiwan?
I am worried. I'm quite worried. But I don't think China's stupid enough. I'm not a military analyst by any means, but it would be extremely difficult to do an actual, I mean, if we're talking about an actual invasion, and a physical takeover of Taiwan, that would be, first of all, there's no secret attack. There's no Pearl Harbors in 2021 of that nature. It's impossible to launch a surprise attack. You know, they would have to build up an invasion force over a period of months. Everybody would know what's coming.
Yeah, or what if they just did what they did in Hong Kong? And just
they already controlled Hong Kong physically. They don't control Taiwan. Taiwan has an independent government, has an independent military. They've got fighter jets. They've got surface-to-air missiles. They've got submarines. They've got, you know, a small navy of their own. They've got radars. They've got anti-ship missiles. They've got all that stuff. And they're trying to buy more all the time. We're their number one arms dealer, right? They've got their indigenous army. They've got tanks. They're buying a bunch of Abrams tanks now, I think like 100 tanks. They're heavily fortified. And Taiwan is not an easy island to invade by any means. I mean, we kind of skipped it in World War II when we were fighting the Japanese. We did the Philippines. We did Okinawa. We didn't do Taiwan. Taiwan's most of the islands, from an amphibious perspective, not amenable to attack. And all the places that are heavily defended. And then on top of that, there's the weather that's very high seas there. There's only a couple times a year that you could actually probably be able to do an invasion. So if China wants to take over Taiwan forcibly, you know, I'm scratching my head as to how they would do it right now. Maybe, you know, and there's been a shift in military technology where over the last few decades, military technology has gone way more towards favoring defense over offense. So this isn't, you know, the 1940s where you can do an amphibious assault on a near peer country with relative ease if you're willing to tolerate a body count. Somebody with, you know, modern missiles can sink your fleet before they get close enough. So I just don't see China taking over Taiwan anytime soon. Plus, we're taking some strong measures here in the U.S. to bring back significant manufacturing. Taiwan's investing billions and billions of dollars in Arizona. They're going to build state-of-the-art chip. Intel's building big time here now. The news yesterday was that they're going to buy Global Foundries, $30 billion deal. They're a major chip maker if they buy them. I wonder if the regulators are going to allow it, but there's major investment here now because COVID-19 was a huge wake-up call. We're very dependent on these overseas supply chains for, you know, mission critical stuff like chips. Can't do anything without chips. You can't build a car.
Yeah.
You know, anything with an on switch these days has chips. And then, you know, our pharmaceutical supply is another one. China at one point, I think they were actually, when we were trying to investigate the source of the virus, China has actually threatened to cut off our antibiotic supply. So I think there's going to be a major investment there in that. But I think chip makers is a good place to be. I love Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. They're the latest pick in our Technology Profits Confidential newsletter.
Yeah,
they just posted great earnings here a couple days ago. The stock jumped, and they're looking to not, you know, for prices to go up on at the end of the year, or they're not going to discount as much as what they're going to do. But they're running at capacity, so I really like chips, and I think with technology being explosive, it's a good this decade. It's a good long term play for quality buy and holds.
Any other sector that you're looking at? Are you? I mean, I know you recommended Moderna early. Are you still bullish?
Maybe not at this exact moment. I think, you know, I'd like to wait for, I haven't checked the share price of Moderna lately, but I think they got a tremendous platform. COVID-19 was a huge validator. They're making money hand over fist on COVID-19 right now. There are other vaccines that are coming out, however. One company I do like is Novavax, NVAX. A few weeks ago, they had their phase 3 results in COVID-19. Very strong results. It's a very different vaccine technology. It's not mRNA at all. Novavax's technology is called vaccine-like particles. They'll biomanufacture a particle that's like a antigen on a pathogen, and then they'll give you that, and it'll train your body without an actual virus or anything like that. So it's an interesting technology. The vaccine appears to be very safe, highly effective on not just the original virus, but on these variants of concern that we've been talking about. Although I don't know how well it might work on the Delta variant. I don't know if there's data out on that yet.
Yeah.
But you know, there's still billions of people out there unvaccinated, so there's still a big market. Taiwan just ordered their vaccine. Taiwan is not very vaccinated.
From Novavax?
From Novavax, NVAX.
Okay.
They're not highly vaccinated. The Japanese donated some vaccine to them, but it was only a few hundred thousand or million doses, or like maybe a million doses, not nearly enough to cover their population, which is, you know, pretty substantial for an island nation. So they're buying Novavax vaccines. I think Novavax, they've got manufacturing partners here and in Europe, so they can scale with their partners and sell billions of vaccines all over the world. And if you're looking at the kind of numbers we're talking about, you're looking at Pfizer and Moderna making somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion this year each, okay, on their vaccines. So the profit side of things is definitely in place. And if Novavax were to catch up to Moderna's valuation because of that, we're talking some serious gains from the current price in Novavax. So something to think about.
Do you have a third one? I'm just curious, like something that we haven't talked about yet. Just a third area or idea that you're interested in.
Let me look at my list here. Let me look at my, let me see here. I do have one I've been working on. I've got several, but they're going to be going out in our publications. And I don't want to actually tease them yet.
Well, just give me a category then.
Well, there's a bunch of new space stocks coming out. All right. I think one, you know, let's talk about one that's in one portfolio that's really gotten beat to hell, which it was very disappointing, but I do think they have some long-term opportunity, and that's the name of the company is Momentus. All right. They're not yet publicly traded, but they're due to go through an SPAC. A SPAC called SRAC, Stable Road Acquisition Corp. Right now, Stable Road's trading for $10.50. That's almost its trust value. So your downside is basically 50 cents if the deal doesn't go through. Now, the horrible thing that happened with Momentus, so first of all, the company is developing a rocket technology called, it's a water plasma rocket. Now, why do I care about that? It well, in space, it's very efficient and it produces decent thrust. So it's a great way to move things around on your top stage of your rocket once you're in orbit already, or to move existing things in space around. The fuel is water and electricity. So you have, you know, as long as you have electricity through solar panels or what have you, you can generate thrust. It turns the water into a plasma, and the plasma goes out one end, you know, and Newton's laws of motion, the thing's going to go the other way. Very interesting technology. The company was founded by a Russian national, which immediately raised some serious national security issues. They were blocked by the SEC from going through this SPAC public. And then the SEC picked them apart and found some material misstatements in the claims that they were making to the people in the SPAC. They said that they had a perfectly successful test of their water plasma rocket in orbit, and actually they didn't. It was mostly a failure. The pumps stopped working. They weren't able to do 100 firings like they had planned. They did have some successful outcome, but they didn't have a successful space test. And this really killed the price of X-Rack. Okay. Yeah. Now the Russian is out of the picture completely. Okay. He's no longer a factor. And this new CEO, I don't remember this fellow's name, but he's been pretty high up in the military and in the government. So the new CEO is a very well-connected person. I don't think he'd be signing up to head this new company if he thought it didn't have a future. So I do think that from these prices, once this company overcomes its fall from grace, could do really, really well for investors. And we're talking about all kinds of stuff, like not just pushing satellites into their final orbits, which is a huge market, but we're talking this technology being useful for clearing out space junk, all right, for potentially putting together, repairing existing satellites. And who knows, maybe in the longer term future, as a way to go on interplanetary missions. Okay, a major change in the satellite business that really reduced costs was the adoption of ion engine technology, which now instead of amortizing a satellite for 10 years, you can amortize that incredible expense for 20 years or maybe more, because the fuel lasts that much longer. The engine's so much more efficient than a traditional chemical rocket that you could keep your satellite in place instead of 10 years for 20 years. So you could really wring a lot more value out of your investment. So this plasma water engine technology has some important advantages over ion engines, which one of them is more thrust. And it could be potentially a game changer in terms of orbital economics.
That sounds good. All right, Ray, let's wrap this up here. I appreciate you spending time with me. Ray, for those of you that are paying attention, is a science advisor to St. Paul Research and the editor of Breakthrough Technology Alert, among other publications. Like, you have some other publications, but the best way to go find out is just, you're already part of St. Paul Research, just go there and check out Ray Blanco. And Ray has been covering the virus and the vaccines, as we know. So those are important developments. And also the space thing is kind of like capturing people's attention. So good stuff. So I thank you, Ray, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Addison. I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, me too.
Follow Ray Blanco's research offering big wealth potential in the years ahead as he digs into vaccines, virtual reality, private space travel, and more in his free Technology Profits Daily newsletter. I hope you enjoyed this session. See you in the next jam.